Irish traditional music lost a true legend in these recent days with the death of virtuoso fiddle player Sean Keane. In a career spanning more than half a century, Sean played with renowned groups including the Chieftains, Ceoltóirí Cúalann and the Crown Cady Band. He collaborated with the likes of Liam O'Flynn and Matt Malloy, and he released music as a solo artist through Claddagh Records. His exceptional gift as a player meant that Sean could experiment with traditional form while also staying utterly rooted in the music with which, he admitted himself, he was totally obsessed. With me this evening to remember Sean Keane and to celebrate that musical legacy, we have Sean Potts of the Irish Traditional Music Archive and Peter Brown, piper and broadcaster. And Sean Keane himself had a really deep connection to music through his family. Just give us a little bit on the musical formation of Sean Potts. You dealt with this, Sean, of Sean Keane, I beg your pardon. You dealt with this in a documentary that you made recently.
Yes, Sean. Firstly, on a personal level, it's a devastating wrench loss, both to our family, very, very closely connected. And I'd like to extend my sympathy to David Rapportic and Darragh, to his brother James and the many grandchildren and extended family. But he was immersed in music from the cradle. His mother Molly and father Paddy were both great fiddle players, both musicians who took their music from Clare and Longford respectively. And so he was brought up through music, himself and his brother James. And then he was also, it was a house where musicians would visit in Dublin. He was born in 1946 and grew up in Drimna, in the South Dublin suburb. And it was a house where musicians would visit. And when he would be down with his in-laws then, down in Longford, it was music, music, music. So he was absorbing music from a very, very young age. He then, he was sent, I think, he went to a teacher named Johnny Fox on Sundrive Road for tuition. For formal tuition, then he was sent to the College of Music, and that was quite significant because he did develop a strong technique when he was learning art form music, if you like. Though he wasn't inclined to go that direction, he was still drawn back towards traditional music. So you had this. He had a very, very inquisitive and ambitious mind as a young player, and he was already mapped, Sean, from a very young age. It's referenced there that he was a member of the Castle Cayley Band, but he came to prominence in the early 1960s, even the late 1950s, from playing in the Church Street and Piper's Club and Thomas Street. And he was already getting recognised as a very, very talented young teenager. And he was brought into, he won Flat Cole on radio, I think, in 1963, late in 1963. And Sean O'Rea, they brought him into Ceoltóirí Cúalann May in 1964. He was only 17.
Wow.
So now he was absorbing the mind of a great pioneering musician like O'Riordan, and where he was, and he references that in that film as well, about O'Riordan was putting traditional music on the map. All he was getting at the time, all he could get was popular culture, was very, very prominent, but O'Riordan was putting it on, and he became part of that movement. So from a very young age, so it had all the strands leading to great musicianship, but it was his own personal drive to develop an extraordinary technique that got him there.
Yeah, and Peter, Sean touching on it there, is this, I mean, the fact that he came from, I know, different styles across the country, some of them are quite similar, but to Sean Keane's ear, he was listening to every tiny little difference, but he was capable of taking all of those differences, giving them back to us in a very versatile fashion. He had that classical background as well that he had for the period he went to the School of Music at the time. And he seemed to bring all of that to bear in Ceoltóirí Cúalann and, of course, in the Chieftains, where the breadth of music was, you know, moved well beyond any one form, really, or any one genre.
Yeah, I suppose he represented something kind of new in traditional music in that way. Like, there are different things. Sean is after saying it there. You know, he went and he got got good technique, and he probably got some of that in the School of Music in Dublin. He also had a wealth of tradition between his parents and all the people he would have met. And, you know, in traditional music, there are no shortcuts, really, to acquiring the idiom in my book. But so you have those things. But maybe on their own, the thing you really have is what he had was his own musical genius. And he had certain pieces of technique. I don't think anyone was doing them before him. A good few people would have taken after him that way, you know. But I just echo what Sean said there as well. I sent sympathy to his people and to his brother James and that, you know. I mean, I was quite shocked with this because in Milltown Malby, this coming Skull Sour Willie Clancy, on the second Saturday, there's a big concert to remember Willie Clancy because it's the 50th anniversary of his death. And I was talking to Sean only about 3 weeks ago, asking would he play, and he was delighted with this. He was, you know, he was looking forward to it. That someone said to me that he wouldn't be down if there was a Dublin match on. I don't know if that's true or not, but anyway, he was all on for it. So I was really shocked when I heard this, you know. I was very sad because, you know, it's his music. His general sense of what is musicality and that his presence. I mean, this was a big, tall man with a deep voice, you know, and above all, maybe his personality. I'm sure Sean would agree with me in this here. I don't think he had an ego at all. I don't think Sean Keane ever in his life said to anyone, I'm a great player. He never stood up on the table and said it. He knew his own worth, okay, but he was a sort of a shy, maybe not shy, but unassuming man, you know, I'd say that. He had a great sense of humour, but he certainly wasn't pushing himself forward.
Absolutely.
I would never think that of him, you know.
Yeah, and I think that's very true, Sean. This is another thing that comes across in that documentary of yours. I think he's talking about, isn't it, John Kelly or Sean Kelly, the County Clare musician, and he says he was a very unpretentious man, and I thought, you could be talking about yourself there, Sean Keane. He was exactly the same, no pretensions.
Yeah, he said he was a very unpretentious man, and that's why we got on.
Yeah.
So even that, even very subtly, he let it be known. He was utterly unpretentious, yet he had an incredible drive to push the boundaries of what he felt within his own play. He had the ability to do that.
Yeah.
He could back up his desire to absolutely go for it. But it was always rooted in the beautiful nuance that exists within Irish traditional music. And I was only talking to Noel Hill earlier on today, and he, just to put it in context, he said, we have lost the greatest musician of the generation. Yeah. We have lost the greatest.
Yeah, well, there you go. I wanted to play a little clip from your documentary as well. This is Sean Keane talking about ornamentation. He's speaking with Liam O'Connor here. And it's just the simplicity of his knowledge and the great technique that he has that he kind of almost dismisses as, Asheray, just do it. You know, let's have a listen to him speaking with Liam O'Connor on ornamentation.
Do you know the crayons you do in the second part? How do you do those crayons?
I don't know. I just do them.
Yeah,
they're in my head, you know.
Yeah.
And it's very hard as a traditional musician to nail these things down. I don't know.
Am I right in saying you're reaching out for mimicking the sound of pipers as
pipes,
well?
Yeah. It's just a matter of keeping your mind open, you know, and listen, and listen again, you know. Mm. The three most important things in music is listen, and listen.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's Sean Keane there speaking with Liam O'Connor in the documentary that we've been talking about, Sean Keane, A Portrait of an Artist, which is from the Irish Tradition Music Archive. Sean Potts is with us, very much involved in the making of that film, and Peter Brown with us this evening mourning the sad passing of Sean Keane, the great fiddler with the Chieftains, I suppose, is what most people will remember him as, I think, Peter. But I was saying, even as we were playing that, a crayon or a crayon, what exactly is that ornamentation? Because it relates, does it relate to the pipes more than the fiddle, Peter?
It'd be a piping thing. And I'd say that Matt Malloy was one who started cranning on the flute. I don't think I heard him before that. And what it is a sort of a stuttering roll. You heard it there. He would be doing it with the bow. The piper would do it with the fingers. But that gives you a sort of a clue about he was listening to piping. And in particular, he listened to and he loved Willie Clancy and he loved going to County Clare. There's no doubt about that. So, you know, you can infuse your playing with things you hear from other musicians, other styles, but certainly there's piping in Sean Keane's fiddle playing. And the other thing is the way he'd sort of slide up to a note. But he often said it, he loved Willie Clancy. And when you come to talk about it, County Clare was a big thing in his life for all sorts of different reasons.
In fact, let's listen to a tune which I think really exemplifies. We heard the Crahans there in the midst of the piece with Liam O'Connor. But here in an air called Lochnagar, you hear that sliding quality, which that the piper often does, kind of sliding up to the note. And he, Sean Keane, has adapted it here for use on the violin, on the fiddle. A little section there from Dark Lochnagar with Sean Keane playing on fiddle, and Peter Brown and Sean Potts with me this evening, speaking about Sean Keane, whose death was announced over the weekend. Sean, as you listen to that, Peter and I in studio here talking about that sliding quality that he has there. Mm. It's an extraordinary ornament. At times, he almost sounds like a piper in that tune, doesn't he?
Well, that was one of Willie Clancy's great airs, you know. He would have learned that from Willie. And that thing about not the conventional 12-note scale, where that half note in Irish music is a critical part of that sound. And like actually, Paddy Glacken articulates a beautiful description of that tune in the film, where he talks about Sean's ability on the very first note, to capture your heart. He said he captures the bleakness of our music, the artistic quality, the depth of artistic quality that exists, that's inherent in it. And only a true artist can do that.
Yeah.
But he does it, and he said it would break your heart.
And it does. It does. I could see, even as we were listening to it here, Peter, you were feeling that kind of emotion. And that, I suppose in some ways it's the glissando of classical music that he has brought into a traditional form as well. He's kind of marrying the two in some ways there, Peter.
Well, he'd be doing that. It's very moving to hear that, particularly in the circumstances today. Mm. But it's the way he can get a sense out of the air, because, you know, that's an air, to my knowledge, that doesn't have words. There's a song, Lochnagar, which doesn't have much to do with that. So when you're playing that, you have to sort of inject what you imagine the feeling is into it. And Willie Clancy's version of that is superb, and so is Sean's. You know, it's something you just can't. I don't think you can learn how to do that. I think you actually learn. You just have to feel it. You know, there's no doubt about that. Willie Clancy was the only person I ever heard to play that air. Where he got it, I don't know. But Sean is really, it's really very moving, that.
And then he, of course, has the ultimate advice for the musician. Listen, listen, and listen again. I mean, I was watching him in that film of Sean's that we've been speaking about. And there are times when he sits there with his eyes closed, Sean Keane, the music is playing, and you can hear that he is absorbing every single note of what he's listening. He must have been a phenomenal listener and therefore a phenomenal player to play with.
Sean loved the music through and through. And if you do that and you're listening long enough, it just goes into your by osmosis. As I say, I don't think there are shortcuts to that. I think you just get it by hearing it and by feeling it. And in fact, there comes a stage in traditional music when too much technique actually obscures, for my money anyway, the sort of lyrical qualities of the music. But he just has it all there in that.
Let's listen to a clip where he's speaking again from Sean Keane, A Portrait of an Artist, that Irish Traditional Music Archive documentary. He's speaking here about another great piper, Liam O'Flynn.
Well, the first time I played with him, of course, the two of us were only kids. in the Piper's Club in Thomas Street. Liam maintains that we were still in short trousers. I do remember, distinctly remember, he had his college blazer on him. The two old fellas, my father and his father, were sitting there listening to us, you know. That was a really enjoyable experience. We kind of gelled the sound of the pipes and fiddle again, of course. We got on great together. We did a few great gigs.
Sean Keane talking about the great Liam O'Flynn there. And, you know, you talk about understated. We did a few great gigs, Peter. Yeah, yeah. It's an extraordinary kind of understatement, isn't it?
They were very close, Liam, Matt Malloy and Sean Keane. So I remember once I was doing some radio programme with Liam O'Flynn and I asked him, you know, he was going to do it. And I said, I wonder would the others two do it? And he said, they will. We're family. We're like family. Mm. So they were really close. As you say, they grew up together, going to these places, playing together in that sort of natural way. And in fact, they made a beautiful disc together called The Fire of Flame. It's just wonderful music. Simple, yeah, in the sense it's not over elaborated. And Matt and Sean did one too called Contentment is Wealth. And that's just fine listening. If you want to hear good traditional music, you just put it on and hearing it there.
It's easy to forget that Sean Keane was a Dublin man, Sean Potts. You know, well, apart from Peter reminding us that if there'd been a Dublin match, he would have been going nowhere near any Willie Clancy school.
Yeah, he absorbed the very best of what existed in traditional music. And he did that at a young age. Himself and his great friend, Mick O'Connor, like went the highways and byways after the great musicians that existed at the time to learn from them, to mix with them, and then he started to play with them. And he absorbed the best of the music of Wes Clare, of Willie Clancy, John Kelly, Joe Ryan, people like that. He then absorbed the music of Donegal, of the great John Doherty, equally the music of Sliabh Lochra and Padraig O'Keefe. He could master the whole lot, and then the music of Scott Skinner and Scotland, the great reels. You know, which required the technical mastery to be able to deliver. Yeah. And he was able to do all that. And he never backed down as a performer, as a musician. And yet that rootedness that he always had was in his deep love of the music. Even when he talked about his relationship with Matt Malloy and Liam O'Flynn, and particularly with Matt, he says, he didn't say we were both great players, that he'd never sent it. They both shared an interest in the old music,
yeah,
in the music of the people, and they were always fascinated by the tunes and the melodies and the technique and the turns that came from those older musicians. And this was quite, like, that's why he's a beacon for traditional art. Yeah. Because he married all those things, and he was it showed the great leadership and great inspiration for musicians for generations afterwards. And it was one thing, just to finish on when you were talking about the technique, I was talking to the piper Robbie Hannon earlier on, great, one of the best, and we were talking about the piping technique that he displayed on the 1975 solo record, Gussie's Frolics. He says, there's piping technique on that on the fiddle that pipers have yet to master.
Do you know, there's another thing that struck me about him is that versatility. I think it's, who is it? They're in Ní Chlachan at one point talks about his ability to play a set or a slide and a jig, which or a reel, I think it was slide and a reel, which he said, for a Dublin player, that's something to be able to do. Let's have a listen to him, though, in a totally different scenario here. And this is the Tennessee Stud, from the Arkansas Traveller, with Miss Susan Cooper. Let's have a listen to this. And incredible style of playing that's involved here.
Thank you.
just listened. That you were saying to me, Peter Brown, as we're listening to Sean Keane there on the tune called "The Tennessee Stud." That's a Doc Watson tune.
That's right. So he was listening to everything. You know, one thing interesting about Clare, just there was one particular man that they used to go down to see. Who's not? His name would never be up in lights with some others. A man called Patrick Kelly in Cree, who had unusual technique on different ways of tuning the fiddle. And Mick O'Connor, who would be very, very close to Sean. They used to go down together to visit Patrick Kelly. And, you know, not Patrick Kelly was the sort of man, didn't go out and about much himself, but they knew what they were getting. I mean, when you hear Patrick Kelly's version of the Fox Hunter's Reel and you hear Sean Keane, you know where that's, yeah, that's coming from too.
How will you remember him, Sean Potts?
I remember him as a giant of traditional music. I also remember him as a very warm friend to the family, to the traditional music community, and as stated in that statement, Chester, a beacon for our traditional art.
And Peter, I mean, you've known him a long time, from childhood, in fact. Yeah, it's funny. When did you first meet him?
Well, it's funny, when I used to be going into Thomas Street on the Saturday night, I'd say I was about 10, and looking at the age thing, that means that Sean was about 16, and after the lessons with Leo Rosen, you'd be downstairs, and Sean was playing, and there was a particular reel he used to play called the Pulseman's Knock, where you play the tune, but you also flicked a sort of an arpeggio with your left hand on the and I used to be asking him, play it again, and I'd say, just in the nature of the man, he probably was thinking, I wish this young brat would hump off out of this. But he just did it again and again, you know. But I just remember for his music, just his repertoire, his presence on the scene. He's so distinctive. And all the memory, all his experiences, that's all gone from us now. It leaves a big gap in all this. There's no doubt about that. Yeah. One thing, just talking about his personality, I was reading Bill Whelan's biography, The Road to Riverdance, and Sean was playing a session tune for Kate Bush. So he was waiting there all day, but he was being patient. And then he went in and he did the first take. And as they were outside of the control room debating whether they should do a second take or not, Sean just appeared in his overcoat at the door of the studio and said somebody, that'll do, you know, it's OK. And he went and they were sort of saying, this is not the normal session musician thing. But after a couple of seconds, she actually said, this is exactly the way it should be. You know, he was happy. Everyone should be happy, you know. Right, but he's just a great man, Sean.
Yeah,
great
well,
man, Sean.
It's clear for both of you that you've lost not just a colleague, but a friend as well. Sean Potts and Peter Brown, thanks for being with us this evening, remembering the great Sean Keane. And let us leave the last words, or at any rate, the last notes, to Sean Keane and a tune, an air called The Bright Lady. Bright Lady, and air there played by Sean Keynes, whose death was announced over the weekend. Air Yeshlov J, Goroa and the Mulish. If you're a Def Leppard fan, this will bring you back to 1987. Animal, that's Def Leppard's song, as heard on the 1987 album, an album which was called Hysteria. This month sees an epic collaboration between rock and classical royalty with the release of a brand new album called Drastic Symphonies. It's a collection of Def Leppard's greatest tracks, each dramatically reimagined and accompanied by London's Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. The lead single from the album is an orchestral version of the song we just heard. Animal, Drastic Symphonies, has also got orchestral versions of Pour Some Sugar on Me, Hysteria and Turn to Dust. Joe Elliott, Def Leppard's lead vocalist, joins me now. Joe, from my listening to the Drastic Symphonies over the past couple of days, I have to say that Def Leppard and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra seems to me like a marriage made in heaven. How was it for you guys? Was it love at first sight or maybe at first sound?
Pretty much, yeah. It wasn't something that we were banging on their door to do. It was a suggestion made to us. We found a lot of the good ones are, you know. What we're good at is, you know, having things thrown at us and we just go, yeah, I like that, I don't like that, I'm not too keen on that one. But then it was during COVID, we had Diamond Star Halos in the can, but we weren't prepared to release it into the world during a pandemic. So we sat on it for a year. So we twiddled our thumbs, and then it was made as the record label said, well, how do you fancy doing an album with the Royal Philharmonic? You know, I mean, they've done it before with like Queen and the Beach Boys and Elvis and stuff. And we thought, you know, good company. Why not? But we said, but only if we have complete control, as in like, we're not just going to give you the greatest hits so you can just throw some strings on it. Like, you know, just putting icing on a cake. I said, we got to get in there and dig deep. And plus, we want to pick our most symphonic sounding songs anyway that were orchestrated on guitars and stuff like that. Right. So, you know, you listen to the 16 tracks that we did, there's maybe four of them that sound pretty much similar to the way they were with an orchestra, but we've worked it in and weaved it well. But on all the others, we've really stripped back a lot of the stuff. We took all, you know, we turned Pour Some Sugar on Me,
yeah,
inside out, back to front and upside down, you know. And I re-sang some of the stuff because the original vocals were too bombastic to go on a string arrangement like what they were.
Yeah, it's funny that you mention "Pour Some Sugar on Me" there, which is referred to on the album, Joe, as a stripped version. This is a totally different version from the version from what we hear on your album Hysteria. I mean, it's a duet. It's a real love song. Did a whole new side of the song come out to you when you did it in this fashion?
Well, the story of this song is back in 1999, name dropping Elliot here, I went to see David Bowie at the Academy. And I was invited beyond the red velvet rope after the gig. And I was talking to him and a lot of his band. And his producer at the time, a guy called Mark Platy, who was also his bass player, said to me, you really need to meet this girl who's singing backing vocals for us. She's a big fan. Her name's Em Griner. And she's done the most weird version of Sugar that you could ever imagine. And she gave me a cassette or a CD, whatever we had in 1999. And I played it to the rest of the guys when we went back out on tour. And everybody fell in love with her version of the song. When we tried, the string arrangements for this entire album were done by a guy called Eric Gorfain, who's a genius. He does all his demos on a keyboard. Obviously, you're not going to do demos to see how the strings work with a real orchestra. It's impossible. So he does it all on a keyboard. And we tried doing string arrangements on the original version of Sugar, and it just sounded hideous. As it did on Rock of Ages, as it did on Photograph. They're just way too bombastic, which is why we said we have to be in charge of the song selection, because we knew some songs wouldn't work. We didn't even bother with Let's Get Rocked. It's the wrong kind of song to orchestrate. So when we decided that, you know, Sugar wasn't going to work, it was Sav who said, why don't we try Em's version? So it's like, oh, yeah, okay, that's cool. So this version that Em did has actually been knocking around for 24 years.
Like, wow.
But only on her, she did an album of covers, which was released probably only in Canada and has been heard by a couple of thousand people. So when I approached her and said, do you want to do your version of Sugar with us and the Royal Philharmonic? She was like, yeah. So that's how that came about. Yeah. And it works brilliantly.
Yeah, and it's probably the one that changes most on the album. But let's have a listen to one of the tracks from the album, and this is Animal. Now, people will know Animal again from Hysteria, 1987 album, and they'll know that kind of strident guitar opening that starts it off. Let's listen to the version that we get on Drastic Symphonies. So there is Animal in the version that we get on Drastic Symphony's new album from Def Leppard, featuring the band, of course, and the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Joe Elliott speaking to me about it this evening. That's a very different version of the song too. Certainly the opening, those kind of gentle, lush strings. Does that bring out a tenderness in the song that was always intended?
I suppose so. I mean, it's the original vocal from the album because we had all the master tapes, so we were able to deconstruct them, which was what we wanted to do. We wanted the orchestra to be the lead star of this. So there's no ego in this band that goes, well, you can't take my parts off. If we, you know, I changed vocals that didn't work. Phil and Sav were more than willing to say, well, look, just take the bass off because the cellos do it better, or, you know, more appropriately. And Phil was removing guitars every day going, we don't need them. And then I'm just going to put this nice little kind of pling thing on, which is brand new. So we did some overdubs. We changed some things. We took a lot more off than we put on because we wanted the strings to shine, because that's the whole point. You want to hear Animal in its basic, in its original form, play Hysteria. This is us presenting the songs in a different way. So we wanted to present them as differently as possible.
And I wondered, was it also being presented by guys who, let's face it, have been on the scene for quite a while now? Are you more mellow in and of yourself? Are your listeners now in maybe a more mellow place where they might want to sit down in a concert hall looking at an orchestra and Def Leppard rather than be in the throes of a stadium concert?
Well, you know, it's a bit of both. I mean, when we're playing, you know, the rock set, the kids are on their feet from the beginning till the end. And as they should be, you know, and that's how we'd like it. But in this setting, and we've never done it live, so it's a guess that I doubt they'd be up on their feet maybe until the end if we did some hardcore rock stuff. It would be like a night of proms. If you actually watch that on TV, they're going mental. So it all depends on how you present it, I suppose. But look, you know, a lot of our audience have been with us since day one, so they're, you know, they've been on this journey with us for 46 years. The last album had the Diamond Star Halos album had songwriting stretches that we'd never really done before, with things like Angels and Goodbye for Good This Time, which both feature on Drastic Symphonies. We wanted to stretch our wings in a different way and just make a much more of an adult kind of record anyway. That was, you know, we were using, you know, blueprints of things like Rumours or Hotel California, so albums that were rock, but they were just more than just hard rock. You know, they stretched the songwriting abilities of both those bands. We wanted to follow suit. As with regards to Drastic Symphonies, it's until we play it live, I don't really know. But yeah, I mean, if you stick an orchestra behind us with tuxedos and us playing in front of them, it's probably going to be a little more mellow. the same way as when we do a 15-minute unplugged set at the end of the ramp when we play live, everybody kind of calms down a bit, so we can ramp it back up afterwards.
And when you were actually recording in, because it was Abbey Road Studios, I mean, what a place to do an album like this, and with a big orchestra, you'd need a big studio like that anyway, I guess. You know, you were saying that some of the old vocals were used. I think some of Phil's old guitar solos and stuff are in there as well. But was there some stuff done live? Is there a song where you duet with your younger self?
Yeah, absolutely. But we didn't do any of our parts in Abbey Road. We did all our parts to Eric Gorfain's demo keyboard.
All right.
And which sounds 99% exactly the same as an orchestra because it's samples. So, I mean, this is what Guy does for a living. He has to do this for film scores and for orchestrations for people like Page and Plant and Christina Aguilera and people like that. So they have to sound extremely real when you do the demos, which enabled us to go, you know what, my vocal's too bombastic. So, yeah, there's a song called Too Late for Love originally on Pyromania. Mm. And right at the end, on the original version, it's a duet with me and Phil. But I phoned up Phil and said, how much fun would it be if I duetted with my 22-year-old self? And he went, take me off, you know. So I did, and, you know, I listened to it a couple of times, and I just practiced singing along a couple of times, and it just came back to me like getting on a bike, you know. I mean, I hadn't sung it since 1982.
Yeah.
We did the vocals for this a year ago, and I was literally 40 years older, but it's like it worked. It actually worked. It wasn't freaky, but it was interesting.
Yeah, I'm wondering, will it be like getting back on a bike or at least going over some old, well-trodden areas of the world when you come to Dublin on July the 4th? You're going to be here for a big gig in Marley Park.
Yeah, I've been in resident since 1989. I've lived in Dublin twice as long as I lived in Sheffield. So, you know, old haunts. I mean, I was very blessed to be asked to perform on a ghost song called Spillways about 3-4 months ago, and Tobias, when we shot the video for it, in the blue light, you know, I mean, you know, the old haunts that, you know, I mean all the time, when I'm here and not working, if there's a gig on, I'm at the gig, you know.
So it'll be an easy jaunt for you to go into Marley Park.
It's a hometown gig now. It's actually a hometown gig as much as Sheffield is.
Yeah, you know, it struck me too at times listening to the album, and I mean this in a very positive way. It kind of brings out a U2 aspect, or maybe similarities between U2 and Def Leppard kind of came out more for me when I heard it in these orchestral versions. Did you get a sense of that?
I get the similarities to a point. We've known each other since 1984. They've known of us, but once you actually set foot in their country, they're very great, graceful folk who would invite you to a gig or a barbecue or whatever. Musically, I think we've sounded a bit like them more than they've ever sounded like us, but there's definitely overlaps. And in the fact that, you know, two bands that kind of formed in the late 70s, struggled to get a record deal, finally got one. First few albums sold really well, fourth album goes through the roof. There's a lot of similarities there, you know, pretty much the same lineup all the way through. So there's a lot of things that I can see this. And the fact that they just did, you know, Songs of Surrender, and we've done this, this is two artists that are sitting around going, well, we can't tour, we can't do gigs, we have to do something. They chose to re-record 40 songs more acoustically, kind of unplugged. We chose to pick 16 of our more symphonic tunes and do them with the Royal Philharmonic. Vastly different, yet at the same time, there is a kind of parallel there. So, yeah, I hear what you're saying for sure. But I do believe that if you throw any of the bands that have been around from our time, which is like, even if it's as ridiculously different as Iron Maiden and Duran Duran or Depeche Mode or, you know, Simple Minds, they've all got something in common where you can sit around in a bar and go, yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. Because even though the music's not necessarily the same, the incidents that you live through are pretty much identical.
Joe, great pleasure to speak with you this evening. And Def Leppard will be at Dublin's Marley Park July the 4th. Tickets on sale at Ticketmaster.ie. And the record Joe's been speaking about, well worth listening to, Drastic Symphonies, is out on the 19th of May. First track from the album, Animal, is out now. Crime fiction is booming in Ireland, with sales in crime, thriller and the adventure category reaching their highest in 10 years in 2021, when over 900,000 books were sold with a value of more than €10 million. It's also an increasingly popular genre for Irish writers, with many occupying the space, including Benjamin Black, also known as John Banville, Tana French, Liz Nugent, John Connolly and many others. So what is it that makes a great crime novel? What are the elements you need to set your fictional sleuth on a journey to catch a killer? Declan Burke is an award-winning Irish writer, has published many crime novels, including The Lammisters, Slaughter's Hound and Crime Always Pays. Later this month at the Dublin Writers' Centre, he will host a 6-week course for aspiring writers entitled Murder Is Your Business, The Art of Crime Writing. Declan is with me in studio this evening. Irish readers, and we're not alone in this, really love the good Who Done It or Why Done It or whatever type of done it that it is, Declan.
Wildly popular, Sean, and has been, as you say in the statistics there, has been for quite a while. Recently, Irish writers are starting to catch up with the more international in terms of, you know, Irish readers reading Irish crime fiction. And you know, perfectly understandably so, because in my opinion, the Irish crime writers are, you know, every bit as good as their pick, it appears on the on the international circuit.
And people like John Connolly in particular, you know, huge international careers.
Are leading the way, Sean, you know, and John is as an exception to most rules, but he is, you know, when you go to America, John Connolly, you know, they're surprised to hear that he's Irish. He's just that pop, he's that famous. He's, you know, he has, and I suppose his novels are set in America and so forth, but he is one of the great leading lights of crime fiction.
Of international crime fiction, never mind the Irish side of things. So, you're this course of yours. Let's get down to what are the key elements. What are the key elements to do a good crime fiction novel?
Yeah, and look, it's a very important question. Obviously, the key elements to the crime novel are the same as most other novels. We have character, we have plot, we have language and so forth. What we have to do with the crime novel is understand that the crime novel is every other novel in extremis. So the stakes tend to be that much. Now, these are all very broad strokes, Sean. Don't want people ringing up and giving out.
You're doing a six-week course. You can't do it all in 12 minutes.
But the stakes tend to be that much higher. Literally life or death situations. You know, again, broadly speaking, we tend to start out with a serious crime, usually a murder. And these set, you know, establishes the rules of engagement with the reader, because now they know they're in a very serious conversation about what makes society tick. What happens when people broach the great societal taboo of murder? And that's what good crime fiction takes on. And that's one of the main reasons, I think, that it's so popular.
In fact, do you argue that if there's a crime that's hugely central to the whole purpose of the novel, then it is a crime novel?
This is my personal rule, Sean, and I've had many conversations with Declan Hughes, I should say, as to whether The Great Gatsby is in fact a crime novel, because the theory is if there's a crime in the novel and you take it out and the novel falls apart, then it's not a crime novel. Right. If the crime is left in, then it still works, then it is a crime novel. Can we take the crime out of The Great Gatsby and does the novel still work? Well, tune in to the latest conversation.
And Dostoevsky's novel, Punishment, is not as interesting as his Crime and Punishment novel.
Yes, no, absolutely. And look, the crime novel, you know, it's a broad church. It's a very broad church, Sean. And because there's a crime in it, doesn't make it a crime novel. But yes, it is a very broad church, and that embraces literary fiction too.
Right, so then let's get into, I suppose we always need a detective or a private investigator, depending on the period you're in and the location that you're in. Outsiders, quirky habits, all of those things essential?
Yeah, not essential, but very, very useful to the writer, I think, absolutely, to have that kind of duality. So the detective, whether it's, as you say, a private eye, police detective, insurance investigator, whatever it happens to be, they have a foot in both camps. So they need to be part of the machinery of justice, effectively. They are tasked with finding out the truth. But if they're inside that machinery, if they're part of the status quo, then they're not going to really have eyes on all the different scenarios. So you need them to be outside and inside simultaneously if they're really going to be able to deliver the full story to the reader.
And that the way you describe that, you know, because obviously that's quite a complex thing to achieve in the writing of something, because the easy thing to say is, well, this is genre writing, so you just follow you join all the dots and therefore you will make a great novel. It's in the case of genre fiction, like crime writing, it somehow has to obey the rules but not look as if it's hidebound by the rules.
Well, that's 100%. And how each individual writer brings their particular skills or maybe unique skill to those all those common elements to the novel, that's what's going to cause a novel to become more than just a genre novel. Because we're talking about a genre type, but there's great genre novels and there's just not genre novels which plod along. We've all read them, unfortunately.
Yeah, and if you think that you can, you know, create some kind of cliched investigator, then you're in trouble. And I suppose equally, if you think you can create some kind of cliched villain for the piece, the antagonist who's going to has either committed the crime or who's going to commit the crime, if he or she is twirling their either real or metaphorical moustache, that's a problem as well, isn't it?
It is, even if they're doing it ironically. You're absolutely right. You know, the great detectives and also the antagonist, they're the opposite side of the same coin. A really good writer will invest a antagonist, a criminal, with very believable or plausible motives and so forth. They will make them relatable as much as they can. They will, as much as they... Their skills allow, they will have the reader empathise, if not sympathise, with the killer's motives and so forth. Now, we'll set aside the ludicrous serial killer novels, which just have people jumping out and stuff. But a really good novel, the talented Mr. Ripley is one of my favourites, because the character of Tom Ripley, who's played by Matt Damon in the Anthony Minghella film, he is effectively a sociopath, but he's an incredibly empathic character because he's an emotional chameleon. He's alone in the world. He's reaching out. He's effectively seeking for love. He murders his way to love, Sean, which is a very simplistic reading, of course, but Patricia Highsmith was a genius of the genre, so you know, we can't all be doing what she does, but that's a classic example of how to make a brilliant antagonist who is terrifying on the one hand, but incredibly empathic or sympathetic on the other, I should say.
And then there's the aspect of, I'm noting to myself that in 2011, wasn't it, that you edited the collection Down These Green Streets, Irish Crime Writing in the 21st Century. Obviously a reference to Mean Streets there. Setting is vital. But even as I'm saying that, sure, setting's vital to almost every novel, whether it's a crime novel or not. Does it have a particular role in crime writing?
I would say that the vast majority of crime novels tend to be set in urban settings because that's where the greatest, you know, numbers of people are. That's what allows for an anonymity. That's allows the killer to melt away into the crowds and so forth. And then the hunt begins with the detective. But, you know, the rise in Scandinavian noir, for example, Sean, has just been huge. And no one would ever have suspected that that was going to be an ideal setting for crime fiction. Hillbilly noir is quite big in America, and that tends to be set in around the Appalachian Mountains. And it's all about the claustrophobia of the small rural environment. Cabot Cove, Murder, She Wrote, people dying like flies in this tiny little seaside town, Midsummer Murders. It doesn't really matter about the setting. A good writer will take any kind of setting and make it plausible. You know, it's what crime fiction is, what we're talking about. Really, it should be consequences of crime fiction. That's why people read crime and mystery novels, to find out what happens when a murder or when a serious crime takes place.
Which gets into the thorny subject of research. I mean, if you're writing a novel about Peru, you can go on a trip to Peru. If you're writing a murder novel, I presume you're not suggesting for one minute that you should consider trying it out to see what it felt like.
Method acting at its worst, I would suggest. In fact, it's a running joke with crime writers, Sean, about their internet search. If the guards ever had reason to investigate the computers, to be arrested on the spot. I'm told the guards themselves are very, very good for research. They're very open to people. Present yourself with your credentials. They know you're serious and so forth. Don't make the mistake that Brian McGilloway once made, marching into a PSNI station and wondering, you know, where did they keep the arsenal of weapons. Brian had forgotten that afternoon he had been painting his fence red, and so presented himself in his red spattered outfit, and he got quite a few jaundiced looks. But he did find out. Yeah, terrific guy, terrific writer, by the way.
And as I say, Down These Green Streets, I suppose the title of the writing course is a bit of a nod towards one of your favourite writers as well, Murder Is Your Business.
Raymond Chandler. Yeah. People will remember the name, or recognise the name, I'm sure. And probably over the years, my favourite writer. I think he blends a kind of a psychological realism with this kind of quasi-poetic, expressive, hard-boiled versions. Hard to put, you know, too precise a definition on it. But the character of Philip Marlowe he created is the archetype of the great private eye. And he will be one of the writers I'll be leaning on for the purpose
of
the course.
And I'm sure there will be others that will be there as well. Patricia Highsmith,
absolutely
high up on that list as well, because I know she's a particular favourite too. That's Declan Burke. And the course that Declan is telling us about, Murder Is Your Business, The Art of Crime Fiction, is a six-week online course beginning and emerging writers, hosted by Declan Burke for the Irish Writers' Centre. And it begins on May the 25th. IrishWritersCentre.ie will give you all the details. That's our lot for this Monday evening.